Ellie, and they had two amazing kids, Em and Ryan, known as Lefty. For some reason, Violin bonded with the kids, and when she was in town, would take them out for long days of mysterious fun, with the kids sworn to secrecy. The kids always came back smiling and laughing, and they loved Violin. I asked about her mother, Lilith, and Violin's face got a little wooden.
"She's fine,"
was all she'd say. That was okay. It was all I wanted to hear. I was moderately low on Lilith's Christmas card list, somewhere between Vladimir Putin and Satan. We talked and talked, but then it was time for her to go. Violin gave me a sweet kiss on the cheek and a warm hug that left me with a fragment of memory of when she and I had been lovers. Harry looked a little jealous, but he had nothing to worry about. The memories of being with Violin would always be in my head, and in a very special place, but I was in love with Junie, and when I looked into my own future, I didn't see that changing. But damn, that hug felt good. I went upstairs and took a hot shower, shaved, and slept for an hour. Or tried to. What I really did was lay there on the top sheet and stare at the uninformative bedroom ceiling. Not daydreaming about my brother, Sean, and his family, or Violin, or even of Junie, nothing that pure. Instead, I thought about the man who called himself Emir Zalioglu. Did I believe that was his real name? No. After hearing him speak, there was every possibility he was neither Turkish nor even Muslim. He was so familiar, though. Something about him. His voice? Yes. His energy, to borrow something Junie often says. Yes, there was definitely something about his energy, and I was almost positive I'd been in the same place with him before, but where? Why? Under what circumstances? It taunted me, because the more I thought about it, the more sure I was. "Who are you, you son of a bitch?" I said aloud. His words came back to me.
"You will not find what you're looking for, not here and not anywhere you will think to look."
"Who are you?" After an hour, I got up, got dressed, and took a cab to the airport. Island of Frogs, North Korea, Part 3. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Dylan Thomas. Chapter 20. Gaegulisium, 18 nautical miles west of North Korea, Sea of Japan. They called it the Island of Frogs, and Gaegulisium lived up to that name. There were frogs everywhere, toads too, and salamanders. The old man, Byeon-suk, liked the frogs. They made the night pulse like a beating heart, even this late in the year. Regular, calm, soothing. Rather lovely as he sat on a stool, chewing on a stem of withered grass and mending his fishing nets. The day's catch was good, and he'd dragged aboard a surprising variety of fishes, including mackerel, souri, pollock, and sardines, enough to put him ahead of his quota. 70% of his estimated catch was regularly shipped back to the mainland on a government gunboat, and he was allowed to keep anything over that. Some days, that meant he and his wife went hungry. He did, too, so the kids could eat. They'd adopted their grandchildren after their daughter died of cancer and her husband was lost in a storm. The children were still small, 6 and 4. Most days, Byeon's catch was enough, though. They did not starve. Days like today were rare, though, and the extra put him into a good mood. He had a little fire in an old gasoline drum, and it spilled yellow light and a great deal of warmth all around him, keeping his old fingers pliant and nimble as he worked. A small oil lantern was set on a stump to give him better light for the close work. Byeon didn't need or want much out of life. At least not much beyond what he had. His wife, whom he loved, his friends in the village, plenty of fish in the sea, a warm fire, the stars, and the frogs. He'd seen a Huanren frog that morning, and they were so rare, Bjorn had taken it as an auspicious sign, which it proved to be. There were 19 pounds of fish being cleaned by his wife. She would cook some, smoke some, and salt the rest. Life, he mused, was good. Well, except for the flies. They were everywhere, despite the cold, swarming and biting. Bjorn was a tolerant and generally forgiving man, but he would have been okay with it if the frogs ate every single one of the little bastards. That would make the evening perfect. Above the tiny island, a shooting star scraped like a match across the ceiling of the world. Another auspicious sign. Perhaps tomorrow's catch would be as bountiful as today's. He had a few friends he'd like to gift with some mackerel. Bjorn heard a twig break in the jungle and turned, smiling, expecting it to be his particular friend, Gang. Good old Gang Sion was even older than Bjorn. Nobody knew exactly how old, not even Gang. It was a running joke that he was older than the island itself, which had been pushed up out of the water a couple of million years ago.
"Gang, you old goat," he called. "Come and sit down. I have some tea and it's still hot, or hot enough anyway."
However, the shape that detached itself from the dense shadows of the jungle was not his friend. It was slimmer and shorter, and it took Bjorn a moment to make out who it was. It moved to within a few feet of the spill of light from the old man's tiny lantern and then stopped, swaying slowly as if nudged by the gentle ocean breeze. He saw the wisps of long hair dancing around soft shoulders and could just make out the faintness of a pink shirt.
"Hi, Yuan,"
he said, surprised to see his wife down here on the beach when there was so much work to be done with the catch at home. The figure stayed there, moving almost to the pulsing rhythm of the frogs.
"Are you done already?"
There was no answer. Bjorn frowned.
"Ha, Yuan?"
She stepped out of the darkness and into the yellow lantern light. Bjorn looked at the face of the woman to whom he'd been married for 53 years. She was slender and strong, and even age had never taken the twinkle out of her eyes, nor hard work drained the uncomplicated happiness of her smile. She'd been his love, his friend, his flower for all these years. Now, as he looked at Ha Yuan's face, Bjorn Sok felt a terrible dread open up in the bottom of his heart. Her eyes were glassy, and they stared without blinking. She was smiling, but that smile was wrong. Her lips were peeled back to show her remaining teeth, bad like his, gray and rotted. But red. The lantern light showed that. Glistening red. It coated her teeth and lips and ran in lines down her chin to drip onto the front of her blouse. Her hands were red, too.
"Ha Yuan,"
he gasped, dropping his net and staggering to his feet.
"What is this? What's happened?"
Her answer was a sound. The wrong kind of sound. Not a whimper of pain because of some accident, not a cry for help. Ha Yuan laughed. A small, fractured, ugly sound. Bjorn looked at her and then past her.
Where are the children?
Her smile turned into a grin, a huge, crimson smile of awful joy.
"Ha Yuan, where are the children?"
His wife threw back her head and screamed, with laughter, with such hungry, hungry laughter, and then she ran at him, hands reaching and those bloody teeth opening wide. Chapter 21. Transcript of One World, Two Sides with Jillian Bakshi and Dr. Andy Ming, hosted by Mitch Greenfield, Bloomberg Television. Greenfield. And we're back. We've been talking the pros and cons of reunification of the two Koreas. Dr. Andy Ming expresses some concerns, and Jillian Bakshi is arguing for it. Many experts have debated the economic benefits versus costs of reunification, while some analysts focus on the tremendous economic potential of a unified Korea. Others express concern over the price tag of bringing North Korea up to the standards of living and education enjoyed in the South. Bakshi.
And yet we've seen solid steps in the right direction. Leader Kim has pledged to end the testing of nuclear weapons and agreed to dismantle the Punggye-ri nuclear testing site.
Ming.
Excuse me, Jillian, but geologists have already indicated that the Punggye-ri collapsed some time ago. Kim's offer of dismantling it appears to be greatly disingenuous, and although he hasn't detonated any new devices, there is every indication that he continues nuclear weapons development. He's made it quite clear he wants the U.S. to remove troops from South Korea before he'll take any real action. And even then, I have my doubts.
Greenfield. Let's shift focus a bit to China. Kim Jong-un has gone there several times without disclosing the substance of those talks. Some experts have suggested he has been going there to lay the groundwork for reunification, which would necessarily involve China, as they are part of the ceasefire. Bakshi.
Well, I may lose my optimist card there, Mitch, because I don't think that's why he's been going there. I think Andy will agree with me that he's been called on the carpet by the Chinese president.
Ming.
We absolutely agree on that, Jillian. His saber-rattling and, excuse the crudity, penis-measuring with the American president got out of hand.
Bakshi.
You're absolutely right. Kim was bringing his country too close to an actual exchange of missiles with the world's unrivaled superpower, a contest that could have forced China into the conflict and possibly drawn in Russia as well. Even if that conflict somehow stayed non-nuclear, it would amount to World War III with China, Russia, North Korea, and possibly Iran and a few other nations against the United States and its allies. Apart from the appalling risk to human life and damage to the planet, it would destroy the global economy as we know it.
Chapter 22. Electra Palace, Thessaloniki. 9 Aristoteles Square, Thessaloniki, Greece. The note read, "All work and no play makes Joe a dull boy." The note had been slipped under my office door when I got back from Turkey. It was in an envelope that had a room key card for a snazzy hotel. The note was unsigned, but it didn't need to be. I knew the handwriting. Since I'd already written my after-action report on the flight and had only a loose plan to head to Athens to do some Christmas shopping, I was okay with a change in agenda. That note made me smile. I logged onto the RTI server and told everyone who needed to know that I was officially off the clock until further notice. Then I took my chopper to Thessaloniki, which is the second largest city in Greece, but one I'd never visited before. The town is lovely, but that hotel knocked my socks off. It looms over the Aristoteles Square and looked like a Byzantine palace, with an eye-popping view of the Thermaic Gulf. The hotel apparently had a reputation as a romantic getaway, and the cab driver kept grinning and winking at me. I got out and heard a soft rumble. Above me, the sky had gone dark with rain clouds, and there was ozone in the air. A storm was coming. I went in and stopped at the desk to request that a couple of superb bottles of wine be sent up to the room. The woman behind the counter said that wine had already been delivered. She gave me a knowing smile, too. So, grinning, I went to the elevator and took it to the fourth floor, followed the curving hallway, trying not to break into an actual run. I used the key card and the door clicked softly open. There was a breath of air from inside that was perfumed with Tibetan temple incense and which carried with it the achingly beautiful sounds of the Moscow Symphony Orchestra playing Clair de Lune. She was waiting for me by the window, her back to me, long curly hair falling around good shoulders. I closed the door, shrugged out of my jacket, and came to stand behind her.
I bent to kiss the side of her neck, and she tilted her head to allow it. "I missed you," I began, but Junie whispered a soft, "Shh." There was no talk after that. Junie turned her head, and we kissed, long and sweetly, and it was very likely the most beautiful moment of my life. No drama, no clever conversation, no need for us to be anything but who we were. Junie Flynn and Joe Ledger. Lovers and friends. Deep lovers, true friends. Which means that what there is between us runs so much deeper than physical attraction or chemistry. Everything is built on a foundation of respect and allowing. Neither of us tries to change who the other is. Junie is one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. She is tall, with masses of wild blonde hair, the brightest blue eyes in creation, and creamy skin dappled with freckles. She's been through storms, though, and has scars inside and out. She's beaten cancer 3 times, and also survived an assassin's bullet that killed the baby she'd been carrying. Our baby. And that injury also destroyed her uterus. Our relationship was not there to create a family. We were family to each other, and always would be. She wore a blue Japanese robe and stood with her fingertips touching the glass of the big picture window. I touched Junie's shoulders and leaned close to smell her hair. Junie's skin was warm and perfumed. I kissed very slowly, without haste, enjoying the taste of her on my lips and tongue, biting gently. Junie slid the edge of the robe off one shoulder and it draped down. In the darkened window glass, I could see her reflection. The curve of one breast, full, delicate, perfect, and the dusty rose of a nipple. I saw her nipple grow hard as I kissed my way from earlobe down along the soft curve of neck. Then I reached around and pulled the loose belt open. The robe parted, and its silky length slid down and puddled on the floor. I caressed her stomach and hips, then traced a line up to one breast, moving along its contour as if sculpting it. The underside, the graceful slope to the erect nipple. I took her nipple between my fingers and kneaded it with great slowness and great care. She sighed and leaned back against me, breathing harder with each moment, and reached down to find my hardness. I reached around to her other breast and touched it, explored it, as if discovering the landscape of her for the first time. Then I touched her face, caressing her cheek and lips. Junie bent and caught one finger between her teeth and bit down, almost too hard, but not sweetly. Not. The sky outside had grown dark, and now there was thunder away to the east, deep, strong, but not threatening. Not to us. Junie turned toward me and unbuttoned and unbuckled me. Then, naked, we walked hand in hand to the big bed. There is sex, and then there is true lovemaking, and that is what we did. We made love. What we each do takes us away from one another for days, weeks, even months. Our relationship is not normal, and maybe it shouldn't work. I am a killer, and she, in her way, is a kind of healer. But two people do not need to be alike to be in love. They don't need to parallel each other's lives. They don't need to breathe the same air. Love doesn't require that. When Junie and I are together, we remake the us that we were. Always a bit different because we're realistic enough and adult enough to know that life is always changing us. When we meet again, we accept that we will be slightly different people than the ones who last parted. And so the joining of our bodies was part of a process of reconnection. As that late afternoon became evening and then turned to night, we made love on the big bed. I kissed my way along the constellation of freckles to the soft heat between her thighs, and when she came, she cried out my name in a way that both broke and healed my heart. Then she pushed me onto my back and climbed astride me, reaching down to guide me into her. I brought my knees up to tilt her mouth toward mine. We made love very slowly, with a rhythm unburdened by haste or greed. We were kissing when I came inside of her, and kissing for long, long minutes after that. The rains came and hammered on the windows. It ended so slowly, a winding down. Gasping and trembling, bathed in sweat, painted with the last paleness of twilight. I wrapped my arms around her and buried my mouth in the cleft between neck and throat and kissed my Junie with 1,000 small, sweet kisses. The storm got bigger, and winds whipped the rain against the windows. We lay there, holding each other as the sweat dried on our skin, and listened to it. The only word she said that night was my name. It was enough. It said so much. Chapter 23. Gegulisium, 18 nautical miles west of North Korea, Sea of Japan. The two figures sat in their rubber boat, engines silent. One of them, a tall, young, blonde-haired man with beefy shoulders who declined to share his real name, watched the island through night vision goggles. The other, a slender woman named Ainil Tan, sat hunched over a laptop on which a dozen video feeds were playing out in small windows. The cameras mounted on trees around the island were ultra-sophisticated. They captured everything in 1080p high definition, and the cameras were keyed to adjust colors to compensate for poor light. Everything was crystal clear, and the miniature condenser microphones recorded every cry, every scream, every unanswered cry for help with perfect fidelity.
"We have it,"
said Ainil, looking up from the laptop. There was obvious fear and nervousness in her voice.
"We have enough. Let's go."
The man studied the island for a moment before replying. He lowered his glasses and glanced at the video feeds.
"Give it another few minutes."
"But,"
she protested,
"we have enough."
The man's blue eyes looked black in the poor light. "Another few minutes," he said, spacing the words out, giving them each equal weight and inflection. Then he exhaled. "Look," he said with a bit more patience, "I told you that my sources told me that something big was going to happen here, and..."
"This is big,"
Ainil insisted.
"Oh my God, this is the biggest thing I've ever seen. This will be headline news everywhere."
"But it's only part of the story," he said.
"What are you talking about? Everyone's dead."
He shook his head and looked away toward the beach. "Not everyone," he said.
"What do you mean?"
The man put a finger to his lips and then pointed. She saw him mouth the word, "Look." Ainil looked. For long minutes she stared through the lens at figures moving along the sand. Despite being warned not to speak, she repeated,
"Oh my God."
The man leaned very close and whispered softly in her ear,
"That's why I wanted you here. Now, make sure you're recording."
She was. Despite everything, her youth, the shock of this, the horrors, she was first and foremost an investigative journalist. Ainil recorded even as the tears broke and rolled down her cheeks and her heart beat like frenzied fists on the walls of her chest. Chapter 24. Electra Palace, Thessaloniki, 9 Aristotelis Square, Thessaloniki, Greece. Junie and I had breakfast in the rooftop restaurant at a table by the fireplace. I couldn't even spell half the stuff we ate, but everything tasted wonderful. Everything. We smiled at each other a lot, those sly, secret smiles of lovers who are so recently from the moments of passion that each can still remember the heat of breath on naked skin, the taste of kisses, the languor of afterglow. Somewhere between the eggs with staka and kouluris bread rings, our long, contented silence gave way to conversation. We don't do chit-chat, so she jumped right in and talked about a project she was overseeing at Freetech, which was her company. Freetech was privately funded and globally positioned.
A big part of what they did was to repurpose some of the truly nasty technologies my guys and I have taken away from mad scientists, terrorists, and other various and assorted dangerous nutbags. It always amazed me how much of any given technology could be used to benefit humanity rather than destroy it. Free tech uses elements of that science, but not to cause misery. No. Junie and her team have made huge inroads into water purification, non-GMO crop protection, vaccinations, and so much more. She described one sustainable energy project she was about to launch in Puerto Rico.
"It's a new kind of solar panel system," she said,
excitement sparkling in her blue eyes.
"The standard designs of affordable solar panels are really hampered by the Shockley quiescer limit, which means that if there is a solar irradiance of, say, 1,000 watts per square meter, then the maximum power output that the solar panel can produce is only 337 watts per square meter. It's all about the physical process of the absorption of a photon to generate an electron and then pass it to the band of conduction. So far, there hasn't been any solar panel manufacturing process or technological development of silicon PN junction cells that can change this. It's been accepted as a factual limitation, but one of Zephyr Bain's projects had been on the edge of proving that the limitation was only a theoretical boundary of energy conversion. Our people have taken Bain's work and followed it all the way to practical models. We're going to test them in Puerto Rico, and if it works, if there is another hurricane like they had a few years ago, then we can restore the power grid in days rather than months."
"That's awesome," I said, meaning it. And seeing the delight in her face and hearing the enthusiasm and hope in her voice made my heart happy. Not everyone gets to do what they love, and fewer still are able to have their dream job be one that does measurable good on a grand scale. Junie was the polar opposite of the kinds of people I go hunting for. Instead of being a mad scientist, she is eminently sane. And even though her job and mine keeps us apart so often and for so long, reunions like this were joyful. They made lonely nights less bleak. Sure, that's selfish, but I never claimed to be otherwise. While we were talking, Sean texted us, time difference notwithstanding. He was bursting with news that his wife, Allie, was pregnant with their third child and due in late June. It made me so happy I wanted to cry. Junie and I got on a FaceTime call with the whole family, and maybe we were a little loud, but the other diners saw how happy we were, and most of them smiled and toasted us with coffee or mimosas. A few didn't, and they can go piss up a rope. The call ended with my promise to come visit soon. I dabbed at my eyes, and Junie and I smiled at each other for a long time, holding hands, being together. Being happy, which is something people who know me only at work might think is a rare state for me. It's not, really. I do this job because of the people I love. Sean and Allie, Lefty and Em, Junie, all of the good ones. The conversation went this way and that and shifted subtly toward our new organization as international troubleshooters. Junie was not an outsider when it came to the details of my job. She used to be, as a standard precaution, but when Church formed the RTI, he extended her access from top secret to unlimited.
"I spoke with Joan yesterday," she said.
Joan being Doc Holliday. Apart from being our science chief and a self-made bazillionaire, Doc is the great-granddaughter of the actual John Henry Doc Holliday. Yeah, Wyatt Earp's buddy from that shootout at the OK Corral. The original Doc Holliday had an affair with a prostitute known as Big Nose Kate, and genetics did some weird stuff over the next century and a half, and wound up producing a 6-foot-1-inch super genius who looks like Dolly Parton on growth hormones. Her IQ is off the scale, and she has no visible conversational filters. She dresses and acts like a cartoon character, doesn't give a hairy rat's ass about what anyone thinks, and will flirt with anything that has a pulse. During the Deep Silence case, my last for the DMS,
She and Junie had become friends. Now, they were like sisters. "Oh," I said neutrally.
"She told me a little about what you've been through recently. Syria and Turkey," said Junie. "She said that there was trouble each time."
Trouble was a candy-coated word that Junie generally used to refer to cases where I'd been involved in violent action. "The usual," I said, dismissing it. Junie searched my eyes for a long time. I busied myself with buttering some toast.
"Joe,
it's all good," I said. "We all came home. No one got hurt. Even Harry managed not to get his ass handed to him. Mostly."
"Joe,"
she said it again, changing the inflection, making it a reproof. I leaned back in my chair. We were in a private corner of the restaurant. No one could hear us if we kept our voices down.
"What's the big deal?"
I asked. "It's not like I haven't had tussles before."
"Tussles? Really?"
she demanded.
"You're just going to dismiss everything you went through as if it were two kids shoving each other back and forth during recess?"
"I've been through a hell of a lot worse, baby."
"Don't baby me, Joe. And who cares if you've been through worse? That doesn't change the fact that you've been in two gunfights in 2 days.
She leaned forward and lowered her voice, but infused it with much more intensity.
"You've killed people both times, and you just wave it off as tussles?"
I set my knife down and stared at her. "What would you prefer, Junie? That I curl up in my closet and cry? That I have a psychic fracture over the realities of doing my job? That I check into a clinic for treatment of PTSD? This is what I do. I'm a soldier and a hunter of very bad people. It would be wonderful as hell if we could settle all of our disputes with thumb wrestling, but they're the ones dealing the play. I don't go in with the intention of pulling a trigger, but I know that in virtually every case, that's a possibility. And for the record, I don't shoot someone every time I go out on a case. Maybe one in 30 times, maybe more. So why are you criticizing me for what happened over the last few days?" Junie reached across the table and took my wrist. She gave it a very sharp and very hard squeeze, deliberately painful.
"You listen to me and hear me," she said in the coldest voice I've ever heard her use. "I was not criticizing you for doing your job, and you damn well know it, or should know it. I know," she snapped, cutting me off. "I'm talking, you listen. If you think I'm attacking you for doing your job or the way you do it or doing what you have to do, then you need to check in with Rudy Sanchez and get your wiring fixed. Show me a little respect, Joseph Edwin Ledger, and while you're at it, show yourself a little respect."
"I don't have a problem with self-respect."
"Oh, bullshit. You swing in a range between unfair self-assessment to a kind of professional hubris."
"So humility or pride are character flaws now?"
"When they are distorted so much that you go around acting like killing people is no more significant than swatting gnats."
"That's unfair." She moved her grip from my wrist to my hand. Not as painful, but intense.
"It's not a matter of me being unfair, Joe," she said in a softer voice. "This is me being scared that you might be in danger here."
I stared at her. "In danger of what?"
"Of forgetting what Rudy always says about how violence always leaves a mark. You used to care about how much damage the things you're required to do did to your heart and your soul. Now you seem to think you're wearing impenetrable armor."
"I've been doing this for a long time, Junie," I said. "Do you expect me to flinch each time? I mean, shit, do you want me to be damaged by it?"
"Damaged? No, of course not. And you know that's not what I mean."
"Maybe I don't." A seabird flew slowly past the window, coasting on thermals, its breast a perfect white. A baby crab wriggled, helpless, in its beak. Junie held my hand. Her fingers felt very cold.
"Joe, I'm serious about this. You are being too blasé about this. Either you are acting as if gunfights are nothing to you, like you're some hero from a summer blockbuster movie series, or you're hiding from your true feelings. Either way, that's dangerous."
I said nothing because, quite frankly, until that conversation, I wasn't really aware that's how I was coming off.
Joe,
she said in a softer voice that was filled with love and hurt,
I love you with my whole heart. With my mind, too, which is even more important. You are remarkable and kind and capable of more tenderness and gentleness than anyone you work with would ever believe. You are also the bravest man I know. But you are human, too. You are not indestructible. If you think there is even the slightest chance that you are becoming disconnected from the truth of what you're doing, from the humanity that made you who you are, then I need you to stop. Take a breath. Step away. Allow yourself to feel.
Junie, her blue eyes were filled with love and with pain and with fear.
Joe, please, promise me you'll talk to Rudy about this.
It took a lot for me to say. I promise. It took more to do that than it took to pull triggers in either Syria or Turkey. I knew it. She knew it. Shit. Chapter 25. European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, ECDC. Gustav III, South Boulevard 40, Solna, Sweden, 5 months ago. They were so deeply in love. With each other, with what they did, with who they worked for, with death. She called him Adam, he called her Eve. Those weren't their names, of course. The who they'd once been had been excised from their lives with the same surgical precision they used on jobs like this. Adam had begun that process when he shucked his previous identity like a snake shedding its dead skin. Then he'd helped Eve do the same, carving out the tumor of her past. Cleaning their back trail was easy, even in the internet age. People only thought it was impossible. The internet never forgets and all that, but it wasn't impossible, merely difficult. And there is a joy in doing something difficult. Ask any gamer. Ask a mountain climber. The physical evidence took longer. Schools they had each attended, family doctors, x-rays in dentist offices, therapists, dojos, gun ranges, juvenile detention centers. Everything, though, burns. People with the kind of specific memory that could have evidentiary weight were handled differently. Never the same way twice. That was the key. Never create a pattern. Being patternless was very hard work. It was creative work, patient work, delicious work. And cruelty? Such a useful tool, was an art. Adam and Eve were, without questions, artists of superior skill. Joyful artists, too, never brooding nor tortured. That was for the canvases on which they wrought their masterpieces. Daddy taught them how. They loved him for that. For everything. Sure, they were scared of him, too, but everyone who knew Daddy was scared of him. Unless they were even crazier than Adam and Eve, and they knew they were totally, wonderfully batshit. They could fake sane, though, like now. They drove past the building in a late model Volkswagen Golf, which was the most popular model in Sweden, more so than the locally manufactured Volvo. The Golf was white because that was also the most common. It was a standard model without too many obvious luxuries. A working person's car, a commuter car of the kind that had every reason to be abroad on the boulevard. The mundanity of it made it virtually invisible despite passing the ECDC building 7 times over the last 5 hours. Adam drove because he liked to drive. Eve took pictures because she was better with a camera. Neither had guns or knives anywhere on their persons or in the car. There were groceries in the back seat. There was a car seat for a toddler and some
well-chewed dog toys on the backseat floor. The junk in the boot was deliberately ordinary. A can of oil, the packaging from replacement wiper blades, a jack, a donut spare, bungee cords, a mangled paperback book, a stained cookbook by Camilla Luckberg. The ID they each carried was bulletproof. Adam was Ralph Asplund, a freelance website designer for a manufacturing business. Eve was Leonie, a photographer for commercial real estate. Even deep net searches would find nothing amiss.
"There he is,"
said Eve. Adam smiled.
"Right on time. He's a good doggy."
He slowed the car so that Ronald Lingmerth saw them. If they'd swerved onto the pavement and rammed him, it would not have made Lingmerth jump higher. It was a quiet stretch of street, chosen for that reason, and there was no one to notice. Lingmerth stopped, but Eve shook her head and gave him a huge smile. Adam held up his cell phone as a reminder of consequences and then blew him a kiss.
"Don't make him piss his pants," said Eve, fighting a laugh.
"Oh, his dick's probably crawled up inside his body by now, so no chance of that." Lingmerth kept walking, though his gait was strange, as if his hip joints were welded shut. Eve leaned back against the seat cushions and gave a contented sigh. They drove away, heading to one of their safe houses. There they parked in a double-slot garage, got into the other vehicle left for them, a blue Volvo, backed out, and drove away. One of their team would take the Golf and move it along through channels of used car lots after the car had been thoroughly cleansed. When they were out of the city and in the country, whisking past rows of linden trees punctuated by the occasional alder or birch, Adam's cell rang. Eve took the call and put it on speaker.
"And?"
she prompted by way of hello.
I have it."
Lingmerth sounded like a drowning man, gasping and lost.
"In a secure container?"
"Yes.
Where?"
"Where you said. I taped it to my inner thigh."
Adam grinned at that. "His dick's bigger than mine now," he said.
"Follow the plan," said Eve. "Take a walk along the boulevard. A car will pick you up and take the container."
"And my family?"
"We won't hurt a hair on their heads."
"Swear to me,"
begged Lingmerth.
"I swear,"
said Eve.
"Neither of us will touch your wife or those precious girls, but Ronald..."
"What?"
"You'd better be straight with us."
"I am."
"That container better have exactly what you were supposed to get. Nothing else. Nothing less."
"I did exactly as you said,"
whimpered Lingmerth.
"Please."
"If there is a tracker on it or a wire on you, then you know what will happen."
"Oh, God, I swear to you."
Eve disconnected the call. They drove for nearly a mile before Adam said, "You're wicked." She shrugged.
"That whole neither of us thing that was evil." "Well, it's true, isn't it?"
she said with a sly smile.
"We won't touch them. We will never even meet them."
"Semantics."
"It's what Daddy taught us to say."
Adam grunted and nodded. Eve turned on the radio and found a station for progressive rock. Dream Theater was playing. Old stuff, too. 6 degrees of inner turbulence. She turned it up. They drove on. 20 minutes later, they got a call. When she answered it, she heard a male voice, heavily accented. "Daddy."
"Line."
"Clear."
"Status."
"Everything's in the green."
"Excellent,"
said Daddy.
"We are complete here, then. You have both done very well."
"Are you happy with us?"
"Yes, my sweet. I am very happy with you. Now, it's time to clean things up. Yes?"
The line went dead. Eve and Adam smiled at one another. Cleanup was fun. She punched in a number and a woman answered. A young voice with a Finnish accent that almost, but not completely, hid her native Korean.
"Waiting on the word,"
said the young woman.
"The word is go,"
said Eve.
"Actually, go play. Have fun. Be weird."
There was a bubbling laugh from the other end as Eve ended the call. She turned the phone over, opened it, removed the SIM card, broke it into four pieces, and tossed one piece out the window every few miles. They checked into a bed and breakfast and spent the rest of the day in bed. Every time either of them thought about what was happening to Ronald Lingmerth and his family, their passion spiked, and they were at each other like wolves. Chapter 26. Private Airfield, Corfu, Greece. I leaned against the curved body of the big, expensive luxury helicopter, looking casual as fuck, but feeling a thousand little ants of tension crawling all over my skin. And despite the glorious blue of the Mediterranean skies and mild temperatures, I was pretty damn pissed off. Partly because of my conversation with Junie, and partly because we hadn't moved the needle much following the clusterfuck at the cafe with the bearded stranger. Bug, I said with as much civility as I could manage. I'm pretty sure that I never want to hear the phrase, "we got nothing," again. But you've been saying that to me ever since Turkey.
Yeah, Joe, but that's 4 days, Bug, I said airily.
You have the world's most sophisticated computer, a staff of the brightest nerds on the planet. You have footage from 3 body cams for facial and voice recognition, and you have DNA. And still, you keep saying the same thing.
Sure, but do you want to know what I'm doing right now, Bug?
I'm buffing my boots so they're nice and shiny when I put my foot all the way up your ass.
Bug gave a long sigh. It is what it is, Joe. That isn't very helpful. Okay, let's look at what we have. The name the bearded guy was using, Bülent İmirzalıoğlu, is bogus. We cracked open every bit of data associated with that identity and found exactly what we expected to find. Nothing. Whoever built it was good, but didn't seem to think he needed to go whole hog because the identity was disposable. İmirzalıoğlu, or whoever he really is, probably has a dozen fake identities, and he'll have left every shred of that one behind. As for the physical evidence, there wasn't enough DNA on the beard to give us anything. I can tell you more about the adhesive used to attach it and the coffee he drank than I can about him. The facial recognition is a mess because of the guy's disguise, and vocal recognition isn't the most reliable technology, no matter what you see in the movies. If that guy's voice had ever been recorded, then he was manipulating it to give a bad read, and that's pretty easy to do. And there wasn't enough to give us a reliable syntax evaluation. All we got is the region around the town of Ainsa in Spain.
Bug, I began, but this time he cut me off and it was clear he was as frustrated and testy as I was.
You want my opinion? This guy made you, and I don't mean that he just made you as a cop or agent. No, I think he actually made you, Joe freaking Ledger. He knew who you were. My sound guys tell me that there was a bit of a tremolo in his voice consistent with people who are very excited, and he came straight over to you, not to Harry. And he didn't blink when Violin went past him to the ladies' room. That guy made a beeline straight to your table.
I said, oh.
Yeah, oh.
Shit.
Exactly,
agreed Bug.
And for the record, Mr. Church doesn't think this guy was Kuga. He said that maybe Kuga's been hiring top talent from around the world. So, taking into account how many organizations we've busted up, and I guess more to the point, that you've busted up, there are people out there who know your face and who want to put some bullets through that face.
Well, moose shit, I said.
Plus, ever since Lilith's crew took Ohan off the board, most of his top people are probably on Kuga's payroll. And some of them worked with the Seven Kings, Harcourt Bolton, Majestic Three, or the Jacobies. Every one of those guys probably has a Joe Ledger dartboard.
Big steaming piles of stinky moose shit.
Yeah, said Bug.
Well, I said lamely,
Keep at it. Find me something. Bug said something very specific about what I could go and do with an underaged three-legged female goat and dropped off the call. I shoved my hands into the pockets of my leather jacket and leaned back to stare at the sky. My Sikorsky S-92A Cougar helicopter was parked on a pad at a private airfield owned by a friend of my boss. It had a $14 million price tag, but it didn't cost us a dime. We'd confiscated it from a Chechenian piece of human garbage who'd been a player in the human trafficking market. Top and Bunny had words with him and then pushed him out of the door at 8,000 feet. None of us cried about the fact that they apparently forgot to give him a parachute. I wondered how good it would feel to throw the man who pretended to be Emir Zelioglu. But after a few minutes, my thoughts drifted back to the conversation with Junie, and my bad mood soured even more. I mean, was she right? Or was it proof that the woman I loved really didn't know me very well at all? Not sure either choice was a pathway to happiness. On one hand, I have been doing this for a long time now, and both the DMS and RTI are the kinds of organizations that tend to push a fellow into the path of violent encounters. It's absolutely part of the job description. The fact that I'm good at it means the church uses me more than some of the other senior operators. Is that my fault? Every single one of our cases is pretty much the spec ops equivalent of the last inning of the World Series, with two outs and runners on all the bases. I either pitch it right the first time or very, very bad things happen. Mixed metaphor, but you get the point. They don't put third-string players into that position. I'm first-string. Church knows it, and I know it. I don't brag about it. I don't think it means my dick is bigger than anyone else's. It doesn't make me a better person. It is, though, a fact of my life. What then should I do? Break down and cry every time I have to put one of the bad guys down? I told Junie that they deal the plays. I react. What level of emotional investment should I be required or expected to make? On the other hand, she also accused me of hubris. That stung more than I'd like. How does one find that line between a confident acceptance of one's own abilities and arrogance? Challenging and painful questions to wrestle with. Junie was gone now. She'd taken an early flight to Puerto Rico to meet her team and would be there for at least a couple of weeks, if not a month. Fuck! I snarled, almost spitting the word into the wind. Ghost leaned his big head out of the open hatch and gave a single bark. Not at me and not in response to my expletive. No, it was one of his happy barks. He bounded down to the tarmac and stood wagging his tail as a figure stepped out of a taxi 100 yards away. Ghost looked at me for approval, and from the way his head and shoulders were juddering, I could tell his tail was wagging at warp speed. "Yeah, sure," I said. "Go ahead, you big goof." He was off like a furry white missile and ran to greet his favorite uncle. Despite my pissy mood, I smiled as Dr. Rudy Sanchez squatted down to intercept the happy dog.
Chapter 27. Gaegulisyom, 18 nautical miles west of North Korea, Sea of Japan, 7 hours ago. Lieutenant Ryuk-jung of the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea stood on the beach and looked at the wall of trees. He had a hand resting on his holstered pistol. His platoon of 12 men and 2 women were fanned out along the sand, with cold water lapping around their ankles.
"Sir," said Sergeant Ga, "there is something over there, by that boat."
Ryuk looked where the sergeant was pointing. A small fishing craft, old and battered, had been dragged up under the cover of the leaves of a crooked hemlock tree. Nets were draped over the side and around an overturned wooden stool. He walked over, flanked by the sergeant and a soldier with a rifle held ready, and knelt. There was a small lantern on its side, the wick extinguished and the oil soaked into the sand. The lantern's glass was cracked, and speckled with drops of something viscous. More drops were spattered on the side of the boat, and there were dark patches on the sand where even more had soaked in. The cracked glass showed the color in its truest form, the unmistakable color of blood. Ryuk rose slowly but did not draw his weapon. Blood was not enough to alarm him. Not on an island where everyone made their living by killing something. Fish, squid, pigs, chickens. There was always some kind of slaughter necessary for people like this. His own childhood had been on a cooperative duck farm, and he'd waded knee-deep in blood and feathers from the time he could walk.
"Leave this as it is," he said. "Let's go find the station keeper."
Sergeant Gaud gestured for the platoon to form up. He sent two ahead, and the others followed the non-com and his officer. Although the island of Frogs was predominantly a poor village on a mostly unimportant island, there was a two-man weather station here. The station was not merely there to record weather patterns, of course. Even the least educated islander knew that. It was one of several such stations that monitored movements of undersea craft. Active and passive sonar sensors were positioned at various depths around the island, which was on a spike that rose above sea level but dropped sharply down to a depth of 2 miles, more than deep enough for submarines and even deep-sea unmanned vessels of the kind the Americans were using for undersea mapping and spying. Lieutenant Ryuk believed that these DSRV craft were looking for the best invasion route. They followed a well-worn footpath through the dense subtropical foliage. Birds chattered in the trees, and the tree frogs gossiped from their hiding places on crenulated bark. Sunlight slanted through the trees, and countless bees buzzed around the flowers.
No, thought Ryuk, not bees.
He glanced at the insects. They were flies, blowflies, many of them circling in and out of the sunlight, dipping down out of sight behind the bushes. Which is when he smelled it.
"Ga," he said sharply. "Over there."
The sergeant and one of the soldiers stepped off the path, guns leveled, fingers laid along the trigger guards. The smell was strong, but not yet overwhelming. The lieutenant drifted behind, his gun still holstered, but he'd loosened it. Ready. But for what? Surely not even the corrupt Americans would have dared come onto the island, onto North Korean soil, to commit crimes. Not even they would be so bold. Sergeant Goss stopped in his tracks a few yards ahead. The soldier stopped next to him, both of them leaning slightly forward to look over the leafy top of a dense scrub.
"Gar, what is it?"
demanded Ryuk, pausing. The sergeant said nothing, merely shaking his head.
"Gar, what have you found?"
The soldier beside Gar dropped to his knees. He did it abruptly, thudding onto kneecaps. His rifle fell from his hands and landed with the barrel half buried in the dirt. It was such a strange thing, such a shocking breach of military procedure, compounded by the fact that the soldier did not even seem to notice. He stared at something Ryuk could not see. Stupid man. Surely he'd seen a dead body before, which is what this had to be. Even if Americans had come onto the island and committed atrocities, that kind of overreaction was foolish. And the soldier would pay for it, Ryuk decided. And yet, he did not approach, did not say anything. He was staring at Sergeant Ga, who kept shaking his head, side to side, side to side, over and over, like a metronome.
"Sergeant!"
Ga turned slowly, but he kept shaking his head.
"What's wrong with you?"
The sergeant was staring with wide eyes, and yet his gaze did not seem focused on his officer. Instead, the eyes went left and right, left and right, following the movement of the man's head, focusing on nothing. Nothing. It was in that moment that the lieutenant realized that he heard nothing. The birds had stopped singing. Even the frogs were silent. The only sound was the buzzing of the blowflies. And then Sergeant Gah snarled. An actual snarl. Low and mean and feral, with no trace of humanity. It was a purely animal sound and yet filled with emotion, not with hunger or even hate. This was a snarl of anger, of meanness, of rage. With no warning beyond that sound, the sergeant launched himself forward. His weapon was still in his hands, but Gah seemed to have forgotten about it, or forgotten what it was. He crashed into Ryuk, bearing him backward and down. The officer fumbled for his gun, but lost it, as strong white teeth clamped with crushing force around his windpipe. The world went black and red and full of stars that exploded and quickly faded to dying sparks. His men did not rush to his aid. Not one of them tried to pull Sergeant Gah off of him or attempted to stanch the blood that geysered up into the late afternoon sunlight. They did nothing at all to help him. They were too busy killing each other. Chapter 28. Transcript of One World, Two Sides with Jillian Bakshi and Dr. Andy Ming. Hosted by Mitch Greenfield, Bloomberg Television. Greenfield. Let's drill down a bit more into China's role in all of this. If Korea is reunited, what are the wins and losses for China? Ming.
Well, Mitch, despite China being run by a strict communist party, there is a great deal of diversity of opinion on this topic. Despite state control over the media, various opinions have gotten into media reports, and they're all over the place. Very pro, very much against, and a lot of iterations in the middle. And even with that, the reasons for their stances vary.
Bakshi. True. I've interviewed a number of investors and business owners in the region, and they see the process of reunification as potentially disruptive to business as usual, which is interesting, because most projections indicate that business would prosper in the long run, and stocks would stabilize if there wasn't as much rampant brinksmanship.
Greenfield.
Right. So what are the actual pros and cons?
Ming.
China wants to keep North Korea under its influence. The North is a buffer between South Korea and, therefore, America. It's a wall.
Bakshi.
Only if Kim can keep his finger off the button.
Ming.
Yes.
Bakshi.
Kim's inability to be a reliable, though minor, ally is problematic for China. The presumption is that a unified Korea would inevitably fall under U.S. influence.
Ming.
Maybe. South Korea became an American ally in self-defense. America stepped in to fight China on Korean soil, siding with the non-communist South. Their financial and military support is almost entirely predicated on the status quo. In a reunification scenario, there is no reason that South Korea has to maintain that kind of relationship.
Bakshi.
It goes deeper than that. China has been building very strong new economic and diplomatic relationships around the globe. As it becomes more of a global economic entity, the need for it to be overcautious of its border with Korea will fade. This effort is reflected in its business personality because that is changing the world perception of what a communist state is. The more they grow their economy through trade with other nations, the more they prove the communist model without having to do it through force.
Ming.
True. China wants and indeed needs to become a solid first-tier economy. It cannot sustain its own population without vastly increased trade. However, they bring so much to the table that they've become very popular as trading partners. Oddly, the model that is working for them is closer to the Fortune 500 capitalist model than anything out of the Communist Manifesto.
Bakshi.
Another pro for separation from North Korea is that Kim is not a very trustworthy neighbor. There is the physical danger of angering the U.S., South Korea, and Japan, but equally as important are the optics. Defending Kim gets harder and harder to spin. North Korea is becoming a costly ally who brings little to the table.
Ming.
If North Korea stays separate, though, there is a potential big win for China if they are a key player in convincing Kim to denuclearize. If they can swing that, they instantly become one of the most important statesman nations, a purveyor of peace and common sense, and in political perception, able to do something the U.S. has failed to accomplish. Greenfield.
Which, I guess, is one of the topics that will be discussed in closed-door meetings at the upcoming D9 summit in Oslo.
Ming. There's another way this could spin. If the Koreas reunited, who's to say that the U.S. will be the only country allowed to nurture? China is right there. They have deep pockets, and they are rebranding their nation. They could help smooth the process of reintegration, re-education, and rebuilding.
Bakshi. There is a danger of that.
Greenfield.
What danger?
Bakshi.
North Korea is a nation of 25 million people, maybe half of the population of the South and approximately that of Shanghai. It is highly unlikely America will spend the resources to bring it up to a cultural par with the South. And the South itself can't afford to do that, which means China could step in to offer financial support to the entire country. It is, after all, right there. China had its own cultural upheavals and revolutions and has learned much from that process.
Ming. But there is a long-standing relationship with America and an even longer animosity toward China.
Bakshi. In 1945, America dropped two atomic bombs on Japan, and now they are one of America's closest friends and allies. The same goes for Germany. In terms of politics, loyalty and friendship are dangerously fickle.
Chapter 29. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece.
So, said Rudy Sanchez as he peered out of the helicopter window, Mr. Church bought an island.
Rudy is my best friend, and also my shrink. Well, technically, he's the staff psychiatrist for our little quilting club. He's shorter than me, with black hair and a thick mustache that would have done justice to a 1970s porn star, but he has such natural class and dignity that he makes it work. There's a bit of gray here and there, but it's more from hard use than age, because we're both still in our 30s. Not the years, it's the mileage. And even though he isn't a field op, Rudy's gone down a few hard roads as my friend. He was wearing a wool suit in a dark charcoal, but with a red shirt and an absurdly festive Christmas tie that had dancing reindeer and lots of elves. A gift from my niece that, despite Rudy's usual subdued tastes, caught his fancy. His collection of novelty Christmas ties was beginning to challenge my wardrobe of inappropriate Hawaiian shirts. Sadly, it was too cold for one of those, so I was wearing a flannel shirt and jeans and looked like a beardless lumberjack. If he noticed my mood, he didn't say anything, and I knew Rudy well enough to know that he would wait for a more comfortable moment to ask what was going on. And there was every possibility that Junie already called him, so maybe he was waiting for me to raise the topic. Good luck with that. We were heading across the sparkling blue of the Ionian Sea on a winter morning. The sky was a cathedral ceiling of hard blue, dusted here and there with wisps of clouds that were delicate as bird feathers. Rudy seemed amused by the location of our new headquarters.
It's really quite lovely, isn't it?
He said in his deep baritone. He sounds exactly like Gomez Adams from the old movies. Similar charm and sense of humor, too. Yep, I said. 1,100 acres, leased from the Greek government for 99 years. We have a special agreement that, for all intents and purposes, exempts this place from all governmental control. It's private in every useful way, and we have permission to build, which is something they don't like people to do, especially not on an island with ancient ruins. We had to bring in an archaeologist to make sure we weren't turning those ruins into a topless disco.
Heaven forfend, said Rudy. How did Mr. Church finagle all of these permissions?
He held up a finger before I could reply.
No, let me guess. He has a friend in the industry.
I grinned. Church was notorious for his network of friends. Not all of them were actually in some aspect of business. A great many of them were in the world's various overt and covert military services, and, as I've come to learn recently, in useful places in world governments. I asked him that too, I said. He dodged the question.
Of course he did.
We watched the island grow from a dot to green lushness as we approached. I was a little surprised Rudy signed on to the RTI. When Church closed the DMS, I figured my friend would take the opportunity to retire from this kind of life and go back to private practice. After all, I'd more or less shanghaied him into signing on when I was recruited by Church. Unlike me, Rudy is no soldier and generally lives at a more evolved end of the evolutionary bell curve than I do. His years with the DMS took a toll on him, too. He lost an eye in a chopper crash and nearly lost his leg. The replacement eye was a nifty bit of $6 million man tech that was indistinguishable from the real one, even down to simulated pupillary dilation and movement. But it's fake, and it's a reminder that bad things happen even to good people. Add to that the fact that Rudy has a wife, Dr. Circe O'Tree, and a toddler son, and there were a lot of reasons to call it quits, but he didn't. Instead, Rudy and Circe bought a rather beautiful house in Corfu, where Circe is continuing her work as a top-level consultant on the psychology of terrorism. She splits her time between writing highly classified papers for several United Nations member states and writing non-fiction books on terrorism that tend to leap to the top of international bestseller lists. Couple of things to add here, though. First, because Circe loves Rudy, and Rudy has gotten hurt several times because of his association with me, Circe kind of hates me. A lot. I don't get random invitations for Thanksgiving and Christmas unless Rudy insists, and then there's a fight, so I usually wind up going to visit my family in Baltimore instead. Second thing is, she's Church's daughter. As far as I know, that makes her Church's only living relative, but they are not close. They are, in fact, as not close as two people can get without actively shooting guns at each other. So you can see why I was surprised that Rudy signed on, and even more surprised when they sold their place in La Jolla, California, and bought the property in Corfu. To a place specifically I can reach by chopper from our new headquarters in less than an hour. When I asked Rudy about that, he gave me a shrug. Rudy's good at shrugs. Maybe it's a Mexican thing, but he can put half an hour's conversation into one shrug. Coming up on it, said the pilot's voice over the intercom. The Sikorsky S-92A Cougar helicopter was tricked out with a soundproof cabin, complete with leather seats, a wet bar, and room for 19 passengers. Currently, it was the two of us and Ghost, who was sleeping on a bench seat in the back, his belly filled with Uncle Rudy's organic smoked bison jerky dog treats. Rudy crowded the window like a happy kid. I could relate. There was a lot to see. The main feature of the island was a castle. An actual castle. Not local construction, you understand. Church purchased a building from Transylvania and had it brought stone by stone to the island. The castle had belonged to Francis II Rákosi, a Hungarian nobleman from the early 18th century. And get this, from 1704 to 1711, Francis II was the Prince of Transylvania. Yeah. Like we weren't all going to try and read something into that shit. Bunny actually flat out asked Church if he was Dracula. The boss withered him with a look. I told Rudy the story.
Ay, Dios mío,
he murmured. I know, I said.
You realize Mr. Church may be engaging in deliberate obfuscation so that we are all
constantly looking in the wrong direction when it comes to understanding more about him. I gave him the same kind of look Church probably gave Bunny. "Clearly you have thought about this," said Rudy.
"A bit."
The castle loomed like something out of an old Hammer horror flick, gloomy and turreted. Closer observation, though, revealed the network of antennas on the roof, discreet surveillance cameras, the helipad, and beautifully sculpted gardens. It looked like the kind of place a rich oddball like Johnny Depp would buy.
"Did Church decide on a name for it?" asked Rudy as we touched down.
"Phoenix House," I said.
"Ah."
I told him that there'd been several choices under consideration, with suggestions from my crew, Bug, Doc Holliday, and pretty much everyone else. Among these were Secret Empire, Dracula's Castle, House of Horrors, Mount Olympus, Avengers Mansion, and House of Pain. Church tended not to comment on our choices.
"Even so, Phoenix House," said Rudy slowly. "It's a bit on the nose, don't you think?"
"Tell that to the big man," I suggested. Rudy just laughed. The doors opened and we stepped onto the asphalt of the landing pad, then hunched and jogged through the diminishing rotor wash. Ghost bounded ahead spry as a puppy, which he was not. He was technically a venerable dog of middle years, and one who'd been stabbed, shot, and otherwise banged up on 6 of the 7 continents. But he only played that card when he wanted to be fussed over. This wasn't a belly rub moment, and he seemed to be having fun. He liked this place, and was already making life difficult for the island's rabbit population. He never actually tried to catch or kill one, but they didn't know that, because he tended to chase like a hellhound. The rabbits probably told stories about him. Big damn goof.
"Are you going home for Christmas?" asked Rudy. "I got an invitation from Sean, something about a big home for the holidays thing at your uncle's old place in Robinwood."
"Kind of have to," I said. He cocked an eyebrow.
"Have to or want to?"
"Both. Living out here, well, Baltimore seems like it's on another world, so yeah, Christmas in the country sounds like exactly the sort of thing I need. Who knows, maybe we'll even get snow. Christmas carols round the tree, sleds and snowball fights, and the biggest turkey in North America. A freaking mountain of presents for Em and Lefty to open." He gave me an affectionate smile.
"You are a deeply, deeply corny man, Joe."
"I prefer to think of myself as traditional."
"Sure," he said. "Let's go with that."
Rudy stopped a few yards from the ornate front doors and glanced up at the ancient, gray walls. He wore a frown that cut lines around his mouth and between his bushy eyebrows. Rudy shivered as if the mild December afternoon had suddenly turned arctic. "What's wrong?" I asked. Rudy shook his head.
"It's nothing," he said.
I studied his face. "You sure?" He pasted on one of the fakest smiles I'd ever seen.
"Positive. Come on, Joe. Give me the tour."
Chapter 30. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Phoenix House was a bit of a con man's trick. Apart from not being a manor house for some rich clown with too much money, it was also mostly show. The upper floors were still under construction and uninhabited except for a nicely appointed guard room and Church's private apartment. It was also not actually the headquarters of Rogue Team International. No. That was below. One of the reasons Church bought the island was the fact that it sat atop a massive and very deep series of caverns. A couple of million years ago, the island was a volcano, but the inner walls of the magma chamber burst through into the Ionian Sea, and the volcano kind of melted away, or whatever it is old volcanoes do. Not really sure of the science there. Point is that there were huge pockets in the otherwise solid strata. The Greek authorities didn't know about it because it wasn't mentioned in any of the geological survey reports that were included in the sales materials. Or so they said. My personal theory is the church had that information suppressed by his friends and then eradicated from all records by Bug. What it left us was room to grow, not up, but down and sideways. There was even a channel on one corner of the island deep enough for freighters, so the same ships that brought in the pieces of the castle also brought in thousands of tons of building materials, equipment of every kind, high-end generators, and everything else you might want if you wanted to turn caverns into a base for the kind of work we do. Rudy was absolutely dumbstruck. As I gave him the 50-cent tour, he goggled. Actually goggled. Computer rooms, labs of every kind, comfortable quarters for everyone, a fully functional TOC, Tactical Operations Center, and more. And there were many areas still under construction, a process that was likely to take a couple of years. At the end of a walkway between massive hydroponic gardens, Rudy stopped and turned in a slow circle. He shook his head.
The scope of this is incredible, he breathed. The cost. How could anyone, even church, afford this?
Well, I said, it's not like we haven't picked the pockets of some high-roller bad guys over the years.
Even so, this has to be billions. Many billions.
Many, many billions, I agreed.
And to set this up so fast, not just the construction, but the logistics, the planning and design, hiring the right people, handling the red tape while keeping so much of it under the radar, even for him that must have taken an incredible network, an actual infrastructure, this is all so...
He fished for a word, but I supplied it. Improbable? Rudy cut me a look.
Yes. There is no way all of this was done since closing the DMS.
Not a chance in hell, I agreed. Rough guess, church has been working on this place for maybe 10 years, with things kicking into high gear last year.
Why, though?
But once again, Rudy answered his own question.
Mr. Church is the least naive person I've ever met. He was reading the writing on the wall all this time, perhaps before he even formed the DMS.
That'd be my guess. We walked to the end of the path and stood by a railing that overlooked a huge training facility, much bigger than was needed for 3 5-person teams to prepare.
He has big plans, said Rudy, though I remember him saying that he wanted to keep the group small, like it was when we first met him.
Small enough to pivot, I said. He's said something like that 50 different ways. He really wants us to be ready to roll at the drop of a hat.
And is that likely?
I nodded. Yeah, I think so. Kind of proved that with 2 back-to-back gigs I just came off of. Got a whiff of something, rolled out, did planning on the fly, and resolved everything fast. Tell you, brother, it's refreshing to feel like we're the big cats in the hunt, rather than hyenas stealing meat from someone else's kill. I mean, sure, groups like ours are more reactive than proactive nature of the kind of threats we face, but it feels different. We can move before a dropped match has time to set something on fire. Consider me a fan.
I'm very glad to hear it, Colonel, said a voice, and we both turned to see Mr. Church standing right behind us.
Rudy flinched the way people do when Church seems to step out of a hole in the dimension. Church is a big man, blocky and solid, though I've seen him move, and he is cat quick. His dark hair is streaked with gray, and he looks like he's somewhere in his 60s, but middle age doesn't seem to have slowed him much, or at all. He always wears tinted glasses, which Rudy figures are used to hide the expression in his eyes. Everyone has some kind of tell, and the leading theory is the church knows his eyes are his, so he hides them, the way some professional poker players do. He wears thin black silk gloves because his hands were badly damaged in one of our old DMS cases, and he wears very expensive, though quiet, suits, and never looks ruffled. That's part of the vibe he wants, or perhaps needs, to convey. He's in charge, and he's cool about that. He offered a hand to Rudy. "Dr. Sanchez," he said, "it is a pleasure to welcome you to Phoenix House."
"I'm pleased to see you," said Rudy. "Though I'm a bit overwhelmed by all this."
"Yes," said Church. "It can be a bit much to first-timers."
"You have a secret lair," said Rudy, gesturing with both hands.
"It's hardly that, Doctor."
"No," said Rudy. "It is precisely that. This is exactly what Joe and Bug have wanted for years. A high-tech secret base in a hollowed-out volcano. If it wasn't so real, it would be cliché."
I had to bite my lip to keep from bursting out laughing. The two grown-ups ignored me. "Well, there may be some truth to that," conceded Church, measuring out a slender half-inch of a smile. "After all, it was Bug who found this location and brought it to my attention."
"Ha!"
I crowed, and was again ignored. Ghost gave me a pitying look. "However," continued Church, "as entertaining as the thought might be to some, this place was not purchased to satisfy anyone's pop culture obsessions, I can assure you." Rudy shook his head.
"I'm sorry, sir. And I really don't mean to offend, but I have to reiterate. You have a secret lair in a hollowed-out volcano with a Transylvanian castle as disguise."
And then Rudy burst out laughing. I lost it, too. Even Ghost barked and pranced around. Church endured it. I think he may even have blushed a little, or maybe it was the lighting. "Enjoy your tour, Doctor," he said, and turned to walk away. I saw his shoulders tremble, though, and by God, I think he was laughing, too. Sometimes the world really is that goddamn funny. Until, of course, it's not. Interlude 5. Area 94, secure military black site, Triple I, Arizona, 15 months ago.
"It's time to go,"
said a voice. Santoro came awake all at once. He knew that voice. Voices, really.